Welcome to Twisted Plot Podcast. Here is your host, Evelyn Marley.
I am so excited to talk to you. If you listen to any of my friends, if you ask them, they'll be like, Evelyn's obsessed with attachment theory. Why is this so? I started by listening to a podcast and they were discussing attachment theory. And it was like all the light bulbs in my head just kind of turned on because, you know, I started therapy. I had a coach and I was really starting to work on some stuff. And the attachment theory portion of it was just the missing piece in terms of my relationships. And so I'm so happy to have you on here, because when I found your Instagram, The Secure Relationship, it was curated so perfectly, and the way that you present your information that I was like, who is Julie Minato? I need more information about what you do. I'm so happy to have you on here because I am absolutely thrilled for your expertise on attachment theory, because the way you present it is so great, and about 500,000 plus followers that you have on Instagram. Totally agree with me.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit how you got started with attachment theory and what interested you.
Sure. So when I went back to grad school later in life, I already had all my children, and it was something that I had wanted to do from the time I was in undergrad, but just life went a little, you know, differently for me. And so when I was older, I said, I got to do this. It was just some drive inside of me. So I went back to grad school and I was learning things that I didn't really want to be learning. I was learning about different types of therapy that really weren't resonating with me. What did resonate with me was family systems, which was, I have to give my school credit, we learned a lot of family systems there, and then psychodynamic therapy. And psychodynamic therapy is the study of more about what's going on inside of you on a deeper level that shows up in behavior, as opposed to looking at behavior and trying to shift behaviors in and of themselves. And so I don't know if that's the best way to explain that, but psychodynamic theory kind of evolved into what's called object relations. And that's when in the 30s, 40s, these theorists started really looking at how the personality develops from childhood relationships with attachment figures. That's kind of the first time that started really being deeply looked at. And there were many different theorists talking about many different, they all had their models of how this all plays out. And I was just fascinated, completely fascinated. And it wasn't something we were learning in school. So what I just did is I just, you know, got all the schoolwork done and then just did my own deep dive into object relations. And then object relations evolved into attachment theory. So that's kind of how I wound up at attachment theory. And it just made everything click. Everything made sense. I started working, you know, I didn't want to be a couples therapist at all. I wasn't interested. So I was working with individuals through attachment theory. And then I kind of had to start seeing couples because of some licensing requirements, and fell in love. I mean, I just fell in love because I was like, wow, this is how you really, you know, this is the way to go. This is how to do attachment theory, because you're working with it in the context of the actual attachment. So what I was finding is I was treating individuals and then sending them home to people who weren't, you know, doing the same kind of work. And it was really that didn't feel complete for me. Mm-hmm. So then once I started working with couples, it all started to piece together. And then I found a modality, which is called emotion focused therapy for couples, which is based on attachment theory, and just dove right in. Here I am.
It's amazing, mm-hmm. because you said that you would work with individuals and send them home. And I'm wondering the kickback from that, because like when they would come back and tell you how it would work for them, because once I started doing this work on myself and really understanding my attachment style or my past attachment styles, mm-hmm. I would say that I was really, you know, it was an insecure attachment style. And so once I started working on that, understanding my partner became much easier. It was almost like a formula to understanding someone else.
And, absolutely. Yeah.
And then following your account, it was like every day was a new gem and piece of information. And it was just so helpful. Yeah, no. And I see the people in the comments talk and ask you questions, and you are so active in helping them. And
it's really important to me.
Yeah. Very, very thankful for that. So can you give us a brief overview of the attachment style so people kind of know what we're talking about here?
Sure. Yeah. So a securely attached person, they have self-regulation skills. I want to say it like if you had, you know, a really healthy mom, let's say, you know, it's always the mom. Not really, but I mean, you know, moms are usually the first primary caregivers. But if you had a really healthy early caregiver, what happens is you integrate that caregiving into yourself. And this is where we go into that traditional object relation stuff, where you integrate that caregiver into yourself and the good mother, good enough mother, or the good enough parent becomes part of you, right? Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you're walking around the world with this emotional support system inside of you. And people who don't have that secure attachment, they don't have that inner sense of safety. Like I have something inside of me to rely on for emotional support. So they know what their attachment needs are, right? They know that they need to find a partner who can help them, not make them, mm-hmm. but help them feel valued, feel wanted, feel respected, feel appreciated, feel validated, feel comforted. They know what to look for because they've experienced that. They don't have to think it. They just know that this is what I was raised with, and this is the kind of partner, and this is the kind of relationship that I want a felt sense of. If they get in a relationship with someone who isn't able to provide those kinds of things, it's just not comfortable for them, right?
Right.
And so one is they have a felt sense of what their attachment needs are, and two is that they seek out naturally those who naturally can meet those needs and who naturally have an awareness of what those needs are. So whenever these two get into conflict, they're not having the conflict is about the problem. It doesn't become about we're fighting to meet each other's attachment needs here because we don't know how to begin with. Does that make sense?
It totally does. That makes sense. It's like the actual problem is the outside force that they can directly work together to address.
Absolutely. Yes. And when they haven't learned how to meet each other's attachment needs, all of those conflicts just become code for them trying to get the attachment needs met. So what I do is I go in and I help couples learn how to find this emotional safety, meet each other's attachment needs, find the closeness that they're looking for. And from that secure base, start to be able to go through life together, right?
Right.
So the anxious partner usually had an upbringing where they were not responded to unless they got big, got loud, got emotional, protested, cried, any number of things that they would have to do other than just being a child who has needs. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does on all the levels, but all their energy is poured into outside forces, basically.
Right. Because there wasn't a predictable response. So they had caregivers who would respond sometimes and not respond at other times. So they could never, ever feel certain that they were going to get what they needed. And so what happens is anxious partners in relationships, even when they are getting what they need, it's hard for them to take it in because they don't trust it.
Oof.
Because for them, good things go away.
Oh my gosh, my heart.
Yeah, I know. It's so sad. It really is. It's so sad. So they're just constantly fighting.
Do you find more people that are stuck in the codependent cycle are prone to anxious attachment styles?
Yes. In the codependency is such a complicated, loaded word.
Yes, I know.
So avoidant attached partners can have their own way of being codependent.
Okay.
Anxious attached partners show up more the traditional way that we think of codependency as far as needing that physical proximity, not being able to function unless they know that the partner is close or the partner is accessible. And also, even when they do have those things, they still can't really feel settled inside. Ugh. Because remember, they have not internalized that emotional parent within themselves that's able to say, you're good, you're okay, let's go do this. And
Is it self-parenting that would be a healing kind of thing to work on that portion of healing, that anxious attachment style for them, if they can kind of tune into that in themselves and be like, you are okay?
That's part of it. That's developing a personal secure attachment with yourself, having those self-regulate. There's two types. There's the, what you have inside of you, and then there's what you create between you and a partner.
Okay.
And so the individual, you know, secure attachment is, yes, it's that having the ability to self-soothe, having the ability to self-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that you would get from a parent that would be helpful for you.
Beautiful. Yeah. That's good to know, because I do have some friends who are like, how do I self-soothe if I have an anxious attachment style? Like, what can I do in those moments where I'm feeling anxious? And I'm like, I don't know. I'll ask Julie.
I think the answer to that question is you learn self-regulation skills.
Mm-hmm.
There's different ways to conceptualize it. Some people conceptualize it as, you know, a spiritual being outside of themselves that they can reach to for support through meditation or prayer. I mean, it doesn't have to be a specific religion, just something to reach to for, support, for emotional support or guidance,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Some people, if they're not a spiritual person, they can think of it as becoming their own inner parent. And you want to learn these skills. You want to learn the skills that you may not have learned during childhood, which is to reach and support to people you can trust,
mm-hmm.
To learn self-regulation skills. The most important would be self-regulation, relaxation, breathing, journaling, anything that, you know, there's just so many different things. If you just Google self-regulation.
Yeah, that's what we'll do.
Yeah. It's just, you want to get your nervous system into what's called the window of tolerance.
Ooh.
And yeah, so that's a whole other thing.
we'll have to Google that too, because that sounds good. I haven't heard of that.
Yeah. Well, there's a book called The Body Keeps the Score. Have you heard of that?
I have heard that one. Yes. Yeah.
So that's a really good one for learning these regulation skills.
Thank you so much for recommending that.
Oh, let me say this really quickly. Somatic experiencing therapy. It's called SE, traumahealing.org. SE therapy is amazing for everything we're talking about. What you're learning to do is manage your emotions through your body, where they actually show up, instead of talking about them in talk therapy. So I'm a huge fan, because talking and talk therapy is amazing. It can be great, but talking can also be used as a defense against feeling.
That makes so much sense. I can actually think of an event that happened with my partner where we were doing great, and then I physically felt something happen in my body that I was like, oh, my throat feels like it's closing up. What's happening? Mm-hmm. I can't talk. Why can't I talk?
Wow.
And so my brain was kind of like, maybe you shouldn't talk right now. Maybe you just need to take some time to breathe. And that talking
that
about
was your body. Yeah.
Which before it was always, what are you going to say next to kind of help this person understand where you're coming from? It was an actual physical reaction that I was having. And I noticed it, which I don't think I've ever done that before. But after doing all this work and therapy and coaching, it was a pinpoint for me to be like,
it really hit you at that point, right?
Which was new to me, but I'll have to check out the somatic
experiencing. Yeah, it's you can find one that's trained on traumahealing.org.
Okay.
You don't need to have a lot of intense trauma in your life to benefit from it. Everybody should do it. I really do think everybody should do SE therapy, because we're just so out of touch with our feelings, as far as, you know, our real true, the chemical component and what it does to our bodies of an emotion.
Especially in the moment when we're having those, what do I do? I guess it's fight, flight, freeze or fawn. But
yeah.
But the tense experience of like, oh, what am I going to do? And if we could just kind of get back in our bodies and realize what's going on, then that physical part of it. I talk about this a lot with my friends too.
Well, this is what SE does. It's kind of frustrating for people, because you're used to going into therapy and just talk, 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 talk. And the SE therapist, they don't allow that. So we have our window of tolerance, and above it, we have dysregulated, and below it, we have kind of numbed out, disconnected, dissociated maybe. And so the second you get out of that optimal spot, they teach you regulation skills to get back down into it. So you're virtually spending the session going out and going back in. So then when you go out into your life, it starts to become natural to get your body to go back into that optimal spot.
That's fantastic.
It is.
Totally going to look into that. The avoidant attachment style, can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm so sad. Avoidance gets such a bad rap, and it's really not fair. And part of the reason that they get a bad rap is because part of the anxious defense mechanism is very blaming. And so it's kind of easy to put it all off on the avoidant. I've yet to work with a couple where it's not an equal contribution to the communication problems in the relationship. So avoidant children grow up with, instead of having an unpredictable response from their caregiver, they have no emotional response from their caregiver. And they might have a lot, their needs taken care of as far as, you know, they're fed. And a lot of parents of avoidant children are very good about the logistical pieces of parenting, but they don't know how to provide emotional support or comfort. And so the avoidant has to learn just to stuff that part away, you know, just don't have needs. Their attachment behavioral system just stops. It just shuts down. Right. And so really younger kids, what they'll do is they'll kind of, as a second best strategy, they'll stay close to the caregiver, but they won't be demanding of any attention, but they will want that physical proximity. So I have a lot of couples who will say, you know, we go for a walk, but they don't have anything to say. And that's that piece of like, you know, the physical closeness for them is like that. Well, that's the connection, right?
Yeah.
But then the anxious partner's going, no, I need some stuff here. I need some emotional connection. So they, you know, grow up just having just no clue how to access their emotions.
And, wow.
Yeah. And so some will have awareness of that, and it will be very hard for them because they'll feel like a failure because they can't do it. I don't know if you noticed yesterday in a post I put, imagine, and not in a post, but in the comments, I said, imagine someone says to you, what's happening in your liver right now? Like, what's going on in your liver? What's happening? Tell me about your liver. What's your liver doing? But instead of it being a funny joke, they're really asking you that. And they're really saying, well, because you can't tell me that, you're emotionally unavailable and you're unworthy as a partner. And you're over here going, but I genuinely don't know what to say. That's how it can feel to be an avoidant partner. And then you get into the therapy room, and then the therapist and the partner are sitting there going, well, how do you feel? How do you feel? How do you
feel? Overwhelming, and then maybe shut down even more, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And they just, avoidant attachment styles, really, I think I heard you say they really just want to do their best, and the acknowledgement that they're doing their best, and that they've come to that point where they, but I did it. And so when that part isn't recognized or acknowledged,
yes,
that's when they kind of go into, well, don't you see the other things that I do? Like,
sure.
Why can't that be acknowledged besides this one small thing? I think you said, you gave an example of the anxious being frustrated of a sock on the ground, and you know that I don't like the socks on the ground, and yet here they are on the ground, and the avoidance like, but I do so many other things. Why
sure.
is this?
Yeah. I just vacuumed the whole house. I just unloaded the dishwasher. I just fixed the toilet. Yeah. And see, that's part of this interplay, because the anxious partner, again, they have a blind spot to the positive because they don't trust it, because good stuff never lasted. And so then that shows up with anything that the avoidant partner doesn't do right, then they interpret that as, well, you don't care about my needs. And then the avoidant partner gets frustrated and defensive and shuts down. And the anxious partner isn't getting their needs addressed. So it just keeps, you know, flying back and forth.
Is the negative cycle that you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's the enemy. They don't know how to find each other. They don't know how to talk about the socks in a way that both of them can feel like their needs are being met. So
do they just stop listening at some point because they're internally thinking about how their needs are not met?
Yeah, they're panicking. They're both in a state of panic because the anxious partner's over here are feeling and cared for and seen and loved and validated. And the avoidant partner is over there feeling unappreciated, unseen, and like, I am going to fail no matter what I do.
Oh, that's so heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's really hard for both. And so both of them are in a state of dysregulation. The anxious partner, it shows. The avoidant partner, it doesn't show. So when they did studies on children, you know, a long time ago in the first attachment studies, the avoidant children had more internal measurements of dysregulation than the anxious children.
Why is that?
Because they're not externalizing it. At least the anxious children are
getting it out.
Yeah, it's like exercise. Yeah. That's why you're going to see them not get mad, let it go, appease, you do it your way, and then blow up over the car breaking down or some little thing, not little always, but something that really seems completely unrelated to the relationship.
Wow. Because it just needs to come out.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll come out. And if it doesn't come out big, it's going to come out in little snide comments, sarcasm. Avoidants are really good at jokes with a little bit of an edge to them.
Ah, I see. Because that's like a slow release of something.
It's like a slow. Yep.
Okay.
Go either way. Yeah.
Avoidance. And then the last one, disorganized. Is that what it's called?
I call it disorganized.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And different sectors of psychology have different words for it. I tend toward disorganized. I don't like the term fearful avoidant. It's confusing. So what I do is I take disorganized, and this is all research based, and I divide it into two different categories. So one would be the oscillating version, which is what we think of when we hear fearful avoidant, and they can go, you know, their behaviors can go all over the place, but their core is just this really intense fear of abandonment. And so kind of everything, it's like an escalated extreme version of an anxious attachment.
Okay.
That, yeah. And then we have the impoverished version. That's an extreme version of the avoidant attachment. The commonality between the two is that both have very little ability to self-regulate. The impoverished version handles that by is completely cut off from all emotion. Most of the time, you're not even going to find them in a relationship. These are people who, you know, might be in a job that they're way overqualified for because their life is about maintaining safety and avoiding anything that might cause stress or anxiety, including relationships. So I tend to talk about that less because it's not as common in relationships as the oscillating category, which is lots of, you know, high drama, lots of intensity, unpredictable behaviors, poor sense of self, what we call identity diffusion, where they're dramatically different people from situation to situation or environment to environment. Now, all people need to have different sets of manners in different environments. You know, you're going to be different at a wedding than you are at, you know, a club.
Yeah.
But people with the oscillating category, they don't even know who they are. It's like they're just a dramatically different person because they're also not only behaving differently, but their inner experience shifts so much. They just don't know who they are. And so it's really hard to keep up with them in their relationship because you never know who you're going to get. You know, you never know what the mood swings are rapid throughout the day, as opposed to a bipolar disorder.
Okay.
Where you're going to see someone go through periods of mania for a few days and then depression. It's not like that. And someone can have both, but it's more just mood swings that can happen at the drop of a dime. And so lots of abandonment fear that they can handle with just, sometimes they just shut down or cut off. But it's driven by abandonment fear, even though it can look like it's not. It looks like sometimes it's, I'm going to abandon you before you abandon me.
Okay. And not to be, because I know this is another loaded word, and I really don't like saying it because it's like, I feel like it's
I know what's coming.
You know what's coming. Yeah. So
do you want to say it or
narcissist?
Okay.
Right? Yes. Not to be confused with that, just because there's a few words that I don't like saying. Bully is one of them, narcissist, and codependent slowly becoming one of those, because I think that there's so much more to those words.
Right. And they've taken on meanings that really don't, you know, don't apply to people they're being applied to. Yeah.
As I don't want to say it, I would like to maybe clear up some language behind that so people aren't attaching that label to this attachment style, if you could.
Yeah, it's tricky. Narcissism is tricky. I even myself, I mean, I one of the topics that I really dove into early in my career was narcissism. And I'm still, I still have some confusion about the word. And I think everybody does.
Yeah,
because it's broad. I think that avoidance often get accused of being narcissistic, and they're not. If I had a dime for every couple who came into my office and the anxious partner said that the avoidant partner was narcissistic, I would be a very rich woman. 90 plus percent of the time, they're not. They just, it can show up that way because they can be super flat. Narcissism, I think if I were to really, really put one phrase to it that kind of delineates it, is they genuinely get satisfaction from hurting other people, especially people who pose a threat to them. They are so mired in their own shame that the only way that they can feel good is by having just this over the top sense of superiority. So, and you can see some of that with avoidance, and sometimes because of that, that is part of an avoidant attachment, is the need to, because a lot of times avoidance didn't grow up with any emotional comfort, and the way that they were recognized was with achievements. Mm. And so that can kind of get into that murky area where it's like, I have to be successful and an achiever to be valuable. But it doesn't cross over into narcissism until it gets to a really extreme level. So I'm going to go with someone who really genuinely wants to gaslight people, wants to hurt people.
That's a good differentiation. Like, yeah. Clearer, I believe, than attaching that. Because I do see that a lot flying around the internet. I'm like, no, I don't think that that's what it is.
Yeah. You know what I did is I went into hidden words. You can filter. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but you can put in words that you don't allow to show up in comments.
Oh.
And I put in every version of that word because I don't want, I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of that message being propagated. So.
Well, I'm glad we're clearing that up today, because I think it's an important thing to talk about so people can understand. Otherwise, they don't know, and they're still stuck in that cycle of that word. So,
well, and one other thing to say is that sometimes people wonder, can anxious partners also be narcissistic? My simple answer, and people are complicated, when it comes to psychology, there's no hard fast rules. But for the most part, anxious partners and disorganized partners don't have the emotional sophistication to be narcissistic. There's an element of narcissism that's very cold and calculated. And those who tend toward the anxious side, they're unable to maintain that. They get too emotionally dysregulated.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I think if someone who is more of an expert on narcissism or someone who's read a lot came on, they would say, well, there's this type of narcissist and this type of narcissist. And that is beyond me in this conversation.
Right. So, I totally understand. Yeah. So yeah. I'm interested in your thoughts about this particular idea that I've been trying to ask people about it that are familiar with attachment theory, because something about the secure attachment style, they seem to be able to detach from the expectations of outcomes, which is ironic because attachment, detachment, right? So I'm curious on your thoughts about the idea that is it the securely attached style that has a better way of detaching from those expectations and outcomes that leads them to better regulate their systems, because they're not necessarily saying or worried about, is this going to happen? Is this not going to happen?
Well, I would say securely attached people don't have all of their eggs in one basket, right? So their joy and happiness in life can come from many different sources. Now, first of all, you have to remember they're more likely to be in a, way more likely to be in a secure relationship to begin with, right? They don't, so a little convoluted here, I'm kind of going all over the place, but they don't necessarily detach from the outcome. They're just going to be okay. And they know they're going to be okay if they don't get it the way they want it.
Okay.
They want it. You might want something, right? Mm-hmm. You call your husband and you say, you know, can you pick up the kids from school? I want to go have lunch with a friend who's in town. You want your husband to say yes. But if they say no, you're going to be okay. You're not going to go spiral down this rabbit hole of, oh, I'm not cared about. I never get helped. I'm not getting supported around here. Now, maybe that's true, right? And that, I mean, I don't want to discard that option, but there, it's just kind of a flexibility where it's like, okay, that didn't work out. Maybe I can call a neighbor, or okay, that didn't work out. We'll catch up again later. So it's not necessarily disconnect from the outcome. It's, I'm still going to be okay.
Oh, excellent.
I'm still going to be okay. If I have a partner and I'm reading these Instagram posts and I'm going to therapy and I'm growing and I really want my partner to grow with me. That is my utmost desire. That is option number one. But if that doesn't happen, I'm going to be okay. I'll move on. I'm going to be okay.
That's good to know. And then can people grow if they are coming from an anxiously attached or an avoidant attached, insecure attachment style? Can they grow into the secure attachment style? Is this possible for them to do?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. You what it is you learn, well, here's a list of very common behaviors that anxious partners do to manage their emotions and stay protected. And how can I learn to do other things that more securely attached people would do?
I think that gives hope to a lot of people out there.
Oh, I mean, every couple I work with, I mean, I prefer as a couples therapist to do it in the context of relationships, because that's where you're going to see the stuff show up. I mean, the vast majority of the couples I see, they find a secure attachment.
That's beautiful.
And yeah, by finding it in the relationship, it's a given that they're finding it within themselves. They kind of go in tandem, and then individual therapists, you know, they have many attachment individual therapists have success with that also.
You can tell right away when a couple comes in who's got the avoidant and who's the anxious.
Most of the time. And whenever it's tricky, there's always a disorganized attachment involved.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Almost always. Not always, because some avoidant attached partners are what me and my therapist friends kind of, you know, lovingly call Italian avoidance, which I'm married to one of them. So I can say that.
Oh, tell me more.
They're avoidant, but they're big and loud, and they can be kind of critical sometimes, and they don't look like an avoidant, but when it comes to their relationship with their emotions and their ability to be emotionally available and their attachment fears, and they're avoidant.
Okay.
And then we have what's called soft pursuers, which are softer anxious partners you're not seeing the big dramatic behavior of someone who's a more extreme anxious attachment, but the dynamics are there. They're critical, they're blaming, they're protesting. It just looks a little more. Yeah.
So you said that you're married to an Italian, which
yes.
I'm Greek. So my dad is from Greece. And so I'm very familiar with the culturally passionate versions of the excitement in the voice and when you talk.
Yes.
And it's so funny because when I see two people, you know, arguing in the streets in Greece, they're literally actually just getting along. They're laughing, but it seems very aggressive and intense and all this stuff. And so people maybe looking from the outside are like, oh my gosh, what are they fighting? They're so upset. And then they give each other a hug. So it's that same idea.
There are lots of cultural differences.
Yeah.
For sure.
And then coming together, like, you know, growing up in the U.S. with a partner who's maybe not from the U.S. and learning those attachment styles on top of the cultural attachment styles, you know, of how they were raised.
One of the books, oh my goodness, where is my book here? This is one of my favorite books, Ethnicity and Family Therapy, because it was for the first time I remember, because I'm of mostly English Native American descent. And there's just a lot to go, the stiff upper lip with the English piece. Mm-hmm. And Native Americans tend to be more quiet. And then I'm married to this like Italian guy with 13 siblings and 8 brothers. And when I read that, I was like, oh my God, this explains so much about the areas where we don't line up. It was just mind blowing. It goes through like every version of American, you know, Persian American, Filipino American, and it's written by someone in that exact culture. And they're kind of like, here's kind of the insider information here, you know? So it's really cool.
I am so getting this book because I feel like it would just open up so much just in terms of any relationship or when you meet people from those cultures, just to be more open-minded about where they're coming from.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't put it down. In fact, someone borrowed it from me and never gave it back. And then a very dear client that I worked with for a long time and they moved, she gave that to me as a parting gift. She gave me a new copy. So yeah. Thanks, Jean, if you're listening.
Yeah, thank you. Because I mean, you pulled it off the shelf and now I'm like, hey, now I want some. Do you think if attachment theory was taught when we're younger, would it help with our relationships Because I talk about it with my friends and a lot of them are like, I didn't know anything about this, but it seems like such an important tool in understanding yourself and others. Mm-hmm. Do you think it would be a great thing to introduce into schools? And what age do you think children or young adults could really grasp this?
Well, that's a tricky question. I'd have to think about that for a bit, but I will say this. I think the goal is to create secure attachments. Mm-hmm. Because I think what happens is some people can kind of move into the idea that the goal is learning how to work with someone, like anxious attachments, learning how to work with an avoidant attachment. And that's true. We need to be able to do that, but we don't want to stay there. The goal is to evolve into a secure attachment. So I might kind of shift that into how can we teach the younger generations how to be emotionally supportive, how to move away from this idea that connection is codependency and that it's not my responsibility to take care of your feelings. I mean, there are some truths to those statements, but they go way too far. And we have this belief that, you know, we're supposed to be these, you know, like the Western idea of like cowboys or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I would probably, that would be my first goal. Again, I'm not giving a very clear answer, but the second piece of that would be to teach when that isn't on board, when we don't have a secure attachment, well, here's what's going on with you. You know, here's why you might be experiencing some of these feelings, or here's why your friends might be behaving in some of these ways. I know that, you know, I do a lot of this work with my kids as far as when they're, you know, having conflict, we'll talk about their negative cycle. And I think that would be really great for school counselors to start implementing interventions that through the lens of attachment and helping these kids understand, you know.
Absolutely. Because it starts so young.
Yeah.
Does that happen from household then into the real world relationships? Mm-hmm. For the first time that they start to form the friendships and then it starts happening and forming in a different way?
I think what happens is that kids who are raised in environments that are emotionally supportive to the degree that they develop a secure attachment. No environment that a kid is raised in is perfect. In fact, we don't want it to be perfect. If it's perfect, then they don't learn resilience. But they gravitate toward healthier kids in general. And when they are in a relationship with someone who's kind of toxic, you know, they'll start to recognize that. They'll start to talk to you about that. And so what I've noticed with my kids is that I don't say, well, don't be friends with that person. I have before, and I realize that that doesn't work. But, I just help them process their experience around it and validate them. And then what I've noticed is that leaves them, that gives them the space to really realize this doesn't feel good. I don't, like, it's just kind of teaching them. And that's part of having a secure attachment, is being really in touch with this doesn't, what feels good and what doesn't feel good.
That goes back to that somatic experience.
And it's like, and it's like, am I feeling good most of the time in this relationship and cared about and reciprocated, and or am I feeling kind of yucky most of the time? There's a way of working with attachment that's psycho-ed, meaning explaining it to people. Mm-hmm. And then there's a way of working with it that's actually giving them the support that they need to feel secure. Does that make sense?
Yes, it
does. So that's what we're looking for with kids, is not really, you know, the education piece.
Right. Cause that might be like, huh?
Yeah. It's a little heady, and it can help to learn it, but it's different when you're actually providing the material skills, support, felt experiences of the security. That's what we want them to walk around with.
I have so much more. We're running out of time here, but
I know. I have so much to say.
When my husband's like, "Are you ready?" I'm like, "Oh, I have page after page after stuff here.
I am more than ready."
Like, yeah.
Yeah, never get me to shut up about this topic. So,
I'll touch really quick on your Instagram, just how far you've come with your, you know, I want to say community that follows mm-hmm. you and really just supports you so much in this. How has that been for you in terms of fueling you to do more of what you want to do? Because I think that the future of, and I want to talk like plot twist, mm-hmm. right? Of
attachment
theory.
I can't wait to do that one.
Yeah. So, how has it helped you to spread this information? A friend of mine said, you know, the best way to get the information out there is really to give it for free. And I feel like you are giving some of your best stuff out there for free, and it's been so helpful.
Sure.
So what does that do for you in terms of what your message is that you want to give to the world?
Well, it's been an interesting journey because I had no idea this was going to happen. I think it, like you said, it's like when you just start giving stuff for free. I didn't go into this looking to be at 500,000 followers at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I just went into it because my bookkeeper said I need an Instagram account for my clinic. And I was like, all right.
Okay.
And then I had to put something on there. So I started just, you know, I started drawing my own cartoons. And so
do you draw those?
No, I start at the beginning.
Okay.
Because I was trying to explain concepts, and I doodle, you know, I just doodle. And so I just was like drawing. If you look back at the very beginning, you'll see my little stick figure.
I'm going to now. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And that kind of started it. But I mean, I feel extremely grounded. I feel extremely clear about what I'm doing, and that this is just me being sort of a vehicle. For some reason, I have the right combination of being the right person in the right place at the right time to just get this information out. I don't know what that's going to look like in the future, but here to get this information out and help the world in the best way that I possibly can.
We're all so grateful. So thank you very much for that.
You're welcome.
And you have a book that I ordered that I'm really excited about.
I can tell you the big one is called Secure Love.
Secure Love. That's the one that I ordered. Yeah.
Yeah. That's if you're interested in a dense information packed deep dive, I'm sure you can see that I have a lot to say. I put it all in the book. I threw it all out there. All in the book. It's just everything that I have to offer is in that book. So it explains attachment theory. I tried to not go too much into the theoretical mm-hmm. part of it. I don't really think people want to read that. They just want to know how to get better. And so I just kind of started with, this is where I start with a couple, and this is what I do, and this is where I'm hoping to end with them. So
do you think you'll make one for younger kids too in the future?
You know, I don't know. I have some big time things coming up as far as agents and bigger publishing companies and maybe multiple books. To be honest with you, I hated writing this book.
Oh.
Hated it.
Tell me how you really feel. I don't blame you. I love that honesty though, because I mean, it's not, it's not easy. I see people writing books all the time. I'm like, that looks hard. That looks really hard.
Brutal. It's mentally exhausting. I don't know how many books I've got in me. I'll make the little book with all the Instagram posts all day long, but the big book, it's like, people were like, well, you need to divide it and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, I just want to give people the information. They have it in their hands. Like, here you go.
I like the way that you present the information on Instagram because it's very clear to me. It's concise and it's broken up very well. It like fits well in my brain. I don't know, but.
Well, I'm hoping that's the case. Yeah. The Instagram's not going to end though. So good. For people who need it in those bites, they're still going to get the bites. So,
great.
Yeah. Because I do enjoy that. That's something I enjoy doing. Yeah.
And you answer mostly everybody's questions on there. I'm really impressed the time that you take to really involve yourself with the community. So thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome.
So tell me what plot twist, twisted plot twist. Right? So this, everyone knows that this beautiful podcast is called Twisted Plot, if you're listening. And I would love to hear, you know, your plot twist with attachment theory and where you see it going in the future, because I believe that more people are starting to talk about it, to mm-hmm. investigate it and see how it can help them in developing those secure relationships. So what do you see for the future of attachment theory? What's the plot twist for attachment theory?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is a phrase that I think of a lot when I think of attachment theory, which is the theory of everything. To me, and maybe we could say the theory of everything human, or I don't know. To me, it's the theory of everything. All psychology comes together. I think right now, attachment theory is kind of its own little sector, but eventually, it will be psychology.
Wow.
It explains everything. And if you look at all the different types of psychology, right, where cognitive behavioral or behavioralism or some of the more the narrative psychologies where we're making meanings, somatics, it all, the every single, the reason, how can I say this? The attachment behavioral system is a sequence of inner experiences that combines meaning with, you know, cognitive meaning, with a somatic experience, with an emotional experience, with a protective feeling, and then with a behavior. And all of those elements are all the different sectors of psychology. It is everything. And I think that the future of psychology will absolutely be working from an attachment perspective. I don't know what they'll call it, but yeah. It's going to inform everything. We're going to move away from this ridiculous medical model where everything is just kind of compartmentalized. And there's something to be said for certain disorders, but it's we're going to have to move into this lens to really start helping people.
I think that you're living proof of how much it's affected so mm-hmm. many people in terms of gaining more knowledge about it just by your account and seeing that word spread out. So
yeah,
you're onto something there. I'm really excited to see the future of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did one time a few years ago. One of my supervisors said that she believes that relationship therapy will be the norm therapy of the future. And I can see how that could become true. Yeah.
Fascinating. So, well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. I can't believe how fast that hour went, but I'd love if you could tell everyone where they can find you. You also have your own practice, the Bozeman Therapy. Please tell us where we can find you.
Well, the best place to find me is at The Secure Relationship on Instagram. And that's really where I'm at. I have a couple of little things on YouTube, and I'm on Facebook too. You can see how technically advanced I am, right? Like somebody else does all this. And then I have a website called thesecurerelationship.com.
Great. Yeah. That's where I found you on Instagram. I feel so grateful. It's a, you know, month of gratitude and should be all the time, but thank you so much for doing what you do. And we look forward to seeing more from you.
Well, you're very welcome. And thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Tune in next time, and remember, stay twisted.